Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! There I am. Third switch got flipped. Everything working. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. And I was just checking to make sure I was signed into Skype and everything. There's a little list of stuff that has to get done. But I am. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy, noting really loud and clear on TuneIn. Wonderful. We're off and running. It is Wednesday, the 20th day of August, 2014. Yes, it would ordinarily be prayer meeting Wednesday, and kind of still is. I mean, there's a religion industry story or dozen out there. But given what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, and in many ways in other parts of the world as well, yeah, I thought maybe we'd let the obnoxious old minister of the gospel take the night off. Is that okay? Yeah. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go to find access to the chat room. Nice little crowd gathering even as I speak. Bean, the happy hippie Billy. You try saying that three times fast. Jeremy is there. M. Brandt, Sergi. And, of course, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky. And you, too, can be there, too. It's easy. It's free. Just pop on by. Generally speaking, during the 3 hours when the program is live, okay? But HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom is how you get there. Also at the Horn website, you will find the pop-out player. That's an easy way to get the program stream, either the live program or the rerun stream. There's always something running here unless the internet connection's gone all craptastic again. But, yeah, we rerun Dr. Bill's program and this program 24/7. So you are you're welcome to jump in using that. Or, of course, you can always, if you've got an iDevice, a Smart This, an Android That, you can use the apps from Stitcher and or TuneIn Radio. With the gentle reminder that any advertisements you may see in no wise support the Horn. We don't get any ad revenue from that. We merely provide the content that allows them to make the profits. And we're happy to be listed there. It makes the program more accessible. Let's see. So either one is fine. No, we maintain the program and keep the bills paid strictly on listener contributions, but you know that. And this evening, I am proud to say that thanks to advance work by Roger and by Barry, We've only got $75 to go this evening. No, I'm sorry. We've only got $50 to go this evening in fundraising, which is nice. It's beautiful to get it out of the way before the program starts. So thank you both to Roger and to Barry. It's a lot easier to get where we're going this evening. In point of fact, Roger sent a note. He said, I'm on a tight budget here, but I like that Kincaid. I like the Kincaid show enough to give up 15 lunches. That is really, really humbling and encouraging. Thank you, Roger. Thank you very kindly. Where to go? Well, like I said, I'm not feeling real. I'm just not feeling the whole prayer meeting shtick this evening. Because well, it's just too nasty out there. And to be sure, part of the nastiness is the religion industry. But what is happening in Ferguson, Missouri is so patently evil, such a brutal suppression of rights, such a shameless display of fascism and authoritarianism, that taking the spotlight away from that seems improper. What do I mean? I mean this. This is audio from last night in Ferguson. This is a police officer speaking to a citizen of the United States who has rights and stuff, but apparently not in Ferguson, Missouri. I guess the usual warning goes out, get little Timmy and little Cindy and out of the room, because Officer Friendly is going to use his fun words. Are they gone? Good. They can come back in a little bit, maybe, but for now, just no. Here we go.
Oh, my God. Gun raise.
My hands
gun
are up, bro. My hands are up.
Hands up. Gun raise and pointed. After going. Hands up.
I will fucking kill
hands
you.
Up.
Get back.
Hands up.
You
get back.
You're going
to
kill him.
He's trying to kill me. He's trying to kill me.
Get back.
What's your name, sir?
Go fuck yourself.
Your name's Go Fuck Yourself? All right, go fuck yourself.
Thank you, sir.
Hello, officer. Go fuck yourself.
Officer, go fuck yourself. He's trying to kill me.
What are you doing?
I hope you guys are watching. He had to be told by another officer.
He's not pointing a gun at people right now for no reason.
He threatened to kill my friends.
He's trying to kill me. Yes,
I'm on my stream.
He's
and, oh, you're
the
other stream guy, right? Yeah, yeah.
He's
on my stream, he just said he's going to fucking threaten kill. He's going to kill me.
Let's go.
I
can't believe that shit, man.
Somehow I don't feel like queuing up Lee Greenwood. No. But you heard it there. And just to give you an idea of what the visual was, the thing begins when suddenly some of the protesters see a police officer walking around with his assault rifle shouldered. I don't mean like put away, but I mean it's up. It's, you know, the butt is against his shoulder. And he is sort of randomly aiming it at people. And when people begin pointing it out, he gets more aggressive, and that's when he says, I'll fucking kill you. Now, I just said exactly what the police officer said. And this is another one of those moments when we need to sort of rethink, or I would suggest that the FCC needs to rethink, the Federal Communications Commission, its policy of censoring what it deems to be improper speech on over-the-air broadcast. The American people, A, have heard that word before, and B, are, well, you know, if you give a little, you know, give the little Timmy, little Cindy warning, let little Susie get out of the room and run it. Because that's actual, well, reporting. America needs to hear how its police behave. No one had done anything wrong. No one had tried to provoke that police officer. He was walking around in the middle of the street, pointing his assault rifle at people. And their crime? Their crime was apparently not being sidewalky enough. Who knew? And it wasn't just the one person who got the guy. There was another. Version.
Put your gun down.
Get there.
What are you doing?
Stop pointing it. Put your fucking gun down. Hungry?
Good job, Sergeant.
Stand down.
Put that gun away.
What's his name?
Put that gun away.
I want it.
Hey, put that gun away. Sergeant, tell that guy to take that gun away from him. Sergeant.
Put your gun down.
Get that gun away from him, Sergeant. Sergeant.
Take his gun away.
Other officers had to come and remove him from the situation. The cop who was threatening to fucking kill people. What do you reckon a freedom protector would have done in the same or similar situation? Would a Second Amendment freedom protector have said, take his gun away? Make him quit pointing guns at innocent people. What's his name? Or would a freedom protector say, Wolverines! And started a standing of his ground. Apparently, according to the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri, this officer, whose name we still do not know, has been removed from duty. Some of this stuff almost plays out as if scripted. The letter that the ACLU sent to the Missouri Highway Patrol complaining of this incident is what got the guy removed. It reads as follows. It's directed to Colonel Ron Replogle in the capital of Missouri, Jefferson City. We are writing to ask you to identify and remove a police officer who has demonstrated an inability to perform appropriately in Ferguson. Because the Missouri Highway Patrol has endeavored to de-escalate the situation in Ferguson, we are confident that you will agree that law enforcement officers who are unable to maintain a professional demeanor and exercise appropriate restraint should not be involved. Last evening, a police officer, who we believe to be a municipal police officer, pointed an assault weapon at civilians and threatened to kill them. When asked for his identity, the officer invites citizens to fuck themselves. A recording may be viewed at an URL. We understand that the situation in Ferguson has tense moments and that other officers appear to have intervened to defuse the situation. However, this officer's conduct, from pointing a weapon to threatening to kill to responding with profanity to a request for identity, was from start to finish wholly unacceptable. Such behavior serves to heighten, not reduce, tension. It is also contrary to Missouri State Highway Patrol's efforts to build a positive relationship with the community. Please take immediate action to identify the officer in question and remove him from further duties in Ferguson. Signed, Anthony Rothert, Legal Director, ACLU of Missouri. Credit where credit is due. The ACLU reports that the officer was removed. I don't know if I do not know if his name was released. But like I said, sometimes this stuff almost seems scripted. By now, I'm sure many of you have heard of the for all intents and purposes, troll piece published in the Washington Post by a guy named Sunil Dutta. He is a professor of Homeland Security. Who knew that was a discipline? At Colorado Tech University, and has a 17-year career with the Los Angeles Police Department. Sunil Dutta wanted, I guess, just to share his 2 cents worth, and it's every bit of that, on why police behave the way police behave. A teenager is fatally shot by a police officer. The police are accused of being bloodthirsty, trigger-happy murderers. Riots erupt. This, we are led to believe, is the way of things in America. No, we're not led to believe that. We see it with our own eyes. We hear it with our own ears. We're not being led. Nobody's leading. Facts are facts. But anyway, let Officer Dutta continue. It is also a terrible calumny. Oh, well, huh? Got the fancy words out. Cops are not murderers. Well, one cop appears to be. Another police officer or officers in New York City appear to be. It appears that one is in Ohio, Dayton. Was it Dayton? Yeah. In Utah. In Los Angeles. No officer goes out in the field wishing to shoot anyone, armed or unarmed. Well, you know, I realize you're a professor and everything, Officer Dutta, but you might want to just go and audit that formal Aristotelian logic class. Because that is not the definition of murder. Going out in the field wishing to shoot someone. And while they're unlikely to defend it quite as loudly during a time of national angst like this one, really, this is national angst? It's just angst. People who work in law enforcement know they are legally vested with the authority to detain suspects, an authority that must sometimes be enforced. Regardless of what happened with Mike Brown, in the overwhelming majority of cases, it is not the cops but the people they stop who can prevent detentions from turning into tragedies. That's right, citizen. Only you can prevent cops from killing. It remains to be seen how it was that Michael Brown was supposed to stop Officer Wilson from killing him. I mean, he put his hands in the air and everything, and Officer Wilson still blew him away. Regardless of what happened with Mike Brown, oh, well, there's an interesting point of departure. In the really, you can't even call him Michael. He's Mike. They were buddies. In the overwhelming majority of cases, it is not the cops, but the people they stop who can prevent detentions from turning into tragedies. Officer Dutta will now climb up on the cross, despite the fact that we need the wood. Working the street, I can't even count how many times I withstood curses, screaming tantrums, aggressive and menacing encroachments on my safety zone, and outright challenges to my authority. You know, there are Supreme Court cases on point that say, hey, nobody made you be a cop. Some of this stuff you have to deal with without resorting to shooting people. In the vast majority of such encounters, I was able to peacefully resolve the situation without using force. Good for you. Cops deploy their training and their intuition creatively. Oh, was that what Officer Wilson was doing, being creative? Who knew homicide was a creative act? And I wielded every trick in my arsenal. Arsenal. He has an arsenal of tricks. Not an arsenal of tasers and pepper spray and pistols and shotguns and machine guns and M16s. No, they're tricks. Including verbal judo, humor, warnings, and ostentatious displays of the lethal and non-lethal hardware resting in my duty belt. One time, for instance, my partner and I faced a belligerent man who had doused his car with gallons of gas and was about to create a firebomb at a busy mall filled with holiday shoppers. The potential for serious harm to the bystanders would have justified deadly force. Instead, I distracted him with a hook about his family and loved ones, and he disengaged without hurting anyone. Every day, cops show similar restraint and resolve incidents that could easily end up in serious injuries or worse. Sometimes, though, they just choke the guy to death. Oh, he didn't write that. I said that. Sometimes, though, and this is where it gets kind of Mr. Rogers-y, sometimes, though, no amount of persuasion or warnings work on a belligerent person. That's when cops have to use force, and the results can be tragic. We are still learning what transpired between Officer Darren Wilson and Brown, but in most cases, it's less ambiguous, and officers are rarely at fault. Rarely. When they use force, they're defending their, or the public's, safety. What a stirring defense of things that he doesn't even know, things that he admits he doesn't know about what happened. Even though it might sound harsh and impolitic, here's the bottom line. If you don't want to get shot, tased, pepper sprayed, struck with a baton, or thrown to the ground, baton. It's such a lovely word. It seems so innocuous. He's got a baton. Maybe he's got a spangled leotard and can march down in front of the marching band. It's just a baton. Bull. It's a club. It's a truncheon. It is a tool for beating the stuffing out of people. It is, in fact, an artifact of violence. If you don't want to get shot, tased, pepper sprayed, struck with a baton, or thrown to the ground, just do what I tell you. Citizen. Don't argue with me. Don't call me names. Don't tell me that I can't stop you. Don't say I'm a racist pig. Don't threaten that you'll sue me and take away my badge. Don't scream at me that you pay my salary and don't even think of aggressively walking towards me. Most field stops are complete in minutes. How difficult is it to cooperate for that long? Like I said, sometimes this is like it's like this is scripted. So, in the case of Ferguson, Missouri last night, because see, the goddess of irony never takes a day off. She is always on the job. She never takes a day off. And consequently, immediately after the Washington Post, for reasons God only knows, I mean, what part of the civil discourse does this serve? Being told to shut up and give up your rights because some police officer, rightly or wrongly, has told you so to do. Or else risk getting shot, tased, pepper sprayed, struck with a baton, or thrown to the ground. What happened to those creative tricks? Where'd they go? Because, see, you can watch the video from last night and Officer go... Let's call him Officer Cheney. Since he responded to people, citizens of the United States of America, by telling them to go and intercourse themselves, just like Dick Cheney did. Let's call him Officer Cheney. Officer Cheney was just, you can find the video. You'll see him there. He's walking around in the middle of the street with his gun drawn. And just sort of randomly pointing it at people. Where does this fall in the spectrum of give up your rights that Officer Sanil Dutta recommends? Back up, back up, back up. I will effing shoot you. I'm pretty sure that not backing up is not a summary capital offense in the state of Missouri or any other state. Officer, why'd you shoot him? Because I told him I would. Why did you tell him you would? Because he wasn't backing up fast enough. Or if you think back to the account from our anonymous correspondent the other evening, he wasn't walking right. And therein lies the rub. Because it's a subjective standard that one can often never meet. I'm trying to walk right. Well, you're still not walking right. I'm backing up. Not fast enough. Not backy enough. I will effing shoot you. See how it, and that can, you know, that can become a problem in a hurry. Because, you know, people get shot. You know, we read that in a kind of Mr. Rogers-y way. Let's try it maybe in a more coppish tone and see, Because even a bad actor can tell you that how you deliver a line imparts meaning. So instead of, if you don't want to get shot, tased, pepper sprayed, let's try it this way. If you don't want to get shot, tased, pepper sprayed, struck with a baton, or thrown to the ground, just do what I tell you. Don't argue with me. Don't call me names. Don't tell me that I can't stop you. Don't say that I'm a racist pig. Don't threaten that you'll sue me and take away my badge. Don't scream at me that you pay my salary. And don't even think of aggressively walking towards me. Most field stops are complete in minutes. How difficult is it to cooperate for that long? Because, see, that's more likely what you're going to get from most of these apparently deeply into the steroid culture police officers walking around all bulked up out there with guns. But Officer Samuel Dutta, I'm sorry, Professor Officer Samuel Dutta, continued, I know it is scary for people to be stopped by cops. I also understand the anger and frustration if people believe they've been stopped unjustly or without a reason. I'm aware that corrupt and bully cops exist. When it comes to police misconduct, I side with the ACLU. Having worked as an internal affairs investigator, I know that some officers engage in unprofessional and arrogant behavior. Sometimes they behave like criminals themselves. I also believe every cop should use a body camera to record interactions with the community at all times. Every police car should have a video recorder. No argument, no argument, no argument, no argument. This will prevent a situation like Mike Brown's shooting, about which conflicting and self-serving statements allow people to believe what they want. And you don't have to submit to an illegal stop or search. You can refuse consent to search your car or home if there's no warrant. But a pat-down is still allowed if there's cause for suspicion. What world, what planet does Officer Dutta live on? You don't have to submit to an illegal stop or search. What is left when they come barreling through your door on a no-knock raid? A nonagenarian granny in Atlanta tried to defend herself from an improper home invasion and got blown the hell away for her troubles. A man in Mississippi, as noted the other night, who got his home invaded improperly by the police, killed one of them. And he was sentenced to death on a murder rap for defending himself. So I don't quite understand what "you don't have to submit to an illegal stop or search" means exactly. Officer, you stop me illegally, I'm going to drive away. Well, I'll effing shoot you. Always ask the officer whether you're under detention or are free to leave. Unless the officer, see, by this point in time, we've entered into sparkle pony fairy dust land. Because this is not, wherever he's describing is not the United States of America. Unless the officer has a legal basis to stop and search you, he or she must let you go. Must. How many times does that work on anything but a Monopoly board? Finally, cops are legally prohibited from using excessive force. Well, that certainly saved the day in Ferguson, Missouri, didn't it? The moment a suspect admits and submits and stops resisting, the officer must cease use of force. Sometimes that happens when the suspect, or in the case of Michael Brown, not even a suspect yet, gets all daddy. Now, here's the other side of the coin. But if you believe or know that the cop stopping you is violating your rights or is acting like a bully, I guarantee that the situation will not become easier if you show your anger and resentment. No, no, no. You can't be angry at having your rights violated, citizen. You have to sit there and take it. Because the police officer, citizen, is more American than you are. Whatever your rights are that are being violated, we can deal with it later. Maybe. Because there's all kinds of exceptions. Worse, initiating a physical confrontation is a sure recipe for getting hurt. And how does one go about doing that? Because, you see, you can be wrestled to the ground and choked to death, and you never laid a hand on them. You can be tased and pepper sprayed until your heart stops and you suffocate without ever laying a hand on them. Police are legally permitted to use deadly force when they assess a serious threat to their or someone else's life. And see, that therein lies the rub, as Shakespeare put it. Because what constitutes a threat to their or someone else's life is a very subjective standard that is judged in the moment. You may recall the famous Michael Moore clip where he has the African-American wallet exchange because of the number of people who, and Sparky called this to my attention last night. It's hilarious in a sort of terrifying way. But he sets up a wallet exchange because the New York City Police Department can't tell a black man with a wallet or a TV remote from a black guy with a gun. So they get to use deadly force when they think they need to use deadly force, whether you're acting aggressively or not. You know, say you've got your hands up. Well, if the cop still feels threatened by you, he can blow you away and leave your body to drain its precious fluids into the street for 5 hours in the August heat and humidity of Missouri. Senate officer Professor Dutta has jumped into a telephone booth and changed into a lawyer. We have a justice system, he says, in which you are presumed innocent. We have a system. Whether there's any justice involved is a matter for separate debate. Remind me, I got a little more on that. If a cop can do his or her job unmolested, that system can run its course. The problem is, its course is heavily weighted in favor of the police. Later, you can ask for a supervisor, lodge a complaint, or contact civil rights organizations if you believe your rights were violated. What if you know? What if you don't believe? What if you know? See, not only were rights violated last night in Ferguson and just about every other night, but that police officer arguably was committing a crime against the citizens. He wasn't just violating their rights. He was committing a crime. He was committing something called brandishing. He was directly pointing his weapon at human beings who were no threat to him and threatening to end their mortal existence. The situation was de-escalated by other police officers, not from his unit, who came and walked him away, but they did not take his weapon from him, and he has not been booked on any charges of assault with a deadly weapon or brandishing a deadly weapon. Just because a police officer has a weapon doesn't mean he can do anything he wishes with it at any time he wishes. theoretically, he can't walk into a convenience store and get a bottle of pop by brandishing his weapon. Not to say that they haven't done that, too. And now let's move. Okay, having lawyered up, he's going to unlawyer. And now we're going to go over to smarmy. An average person cannot comprehend the risks and has no true understanding of a cop's job. Yeah, we can. Sure we can. Because we know the terror in our own bellies when approached by the police. In 2014, in the United States of America, any interaction with an officer of the law is a potential life-ending situation. See, you got a taillight out there. Uh-huh. Mind if I search your car? I'm sorry, I'm not. He can sell, I ain't buying. That nobody knows the risks of a police officer. Because if that's true, nobody knows the risks, nobody comprehends the risks of a high iron worker either. You know, one of the folks that works putting up the skeleton of a high rise 40 stories above the ground. Nobody comprehends that risk either. Nobody comprehends the risk of a moviegoer in America in 2014. And I'm not kidding. You know, Ferg and I try to take in a movie every now and then. This weekend we went, if you go early in the day on the weekend, you can get in cheaper. So we went to see Guardians of the Galaxy. What a fun movie that was. Beginning to end. It was just a delightful little sci-fi romp with all kinds of sly little back references and stuff. But after Aurora, Colorado, unto this day, and probably every time I ever walk into a movie theater again, I wonder if some lawful gun owner is suddenly going to become awful. They run that little thing on the screen about turning off your cell phones and putting them away and not texting during the movie. And my mind immediately flashes to, yeah, because some lawful gun owner may blow your freaking head off. Movie theater won't say that, though, because they don't want to scare you away from the movie. I mean, they're in business. They got to make money, right? But Officer Professor Dutta, no one, an average person, cannot comprehend the risks and has no true understanding of what it's like to go to a movie in the United States in 2014. An average person, Professor Officer Dutta, cannot comprehend the risks and has no true understanding of a mother's job when she sends her children, her first grader, to school every morning, wondering if they will come home alive because it's America, because it's 2014. Wolverines. An average person cannot comprehend the risks and has no true understanding of a woman who cannot walk into a healthcare clinic without taking her own life in her hands and wondering when some anti-abortion monstrosity is going to decide that this is the day Jesus wants him to rub out the sinners. Hollywood and television stereotypes of the police are cartoons in which fearless super cops single-handedly defeat dozens of thugs, shooting guns out of their hands. Real life is different. An average cop is always concerned with his or her safety and tries to control every encounter. This is how we are trained. Then maybe you're being trained poorly, Officer Dutta. Because inherent in this entire blatherous screed is the notion that this is how law enforcement behaves everywhere. It isn't. It's how law enforcement behaves in brutal places, like the United States of America. It's not the same thing as how police officers behave in other countries. Although it's getting worse in other countries, because our disease is metastasizing the whole world over. Well, most citizens are courteous and law-abiding, and I am. I don't run around hollering F the police. I'm pleasant to them. I want to be nice to them because the Dutta here says we don't know what is in a cop's mind. Did I just get a radio call of a shooting moments ago? Am I looking for a murderer or an armed fugitive for you? This might be a simple traffic stop for me. Each traffic stop is a potentially dangerous encounter. You see, the cops, what he's saying is that the cops are as scared of us as we are of them, the difference being that the cops, more often than not, are the ones with the deadly weapons. Dutta says, don't make our job more difficult than it already is. Community members, he says, deserve courtesy, respect, and professionalism from their officers. Every person stopped by a cop should feel safe instead of feeling that their well-being is in jeopardy. But that is precisely the point. We don't feel that way anymore. We wonder if in any given moment it's going to be the end of our existence because the police officer is having a bad day, or maybe he or she found out their partner is having an affair. And I don't mean their police partner, I mean spouse, loved one. Maybe somebody at home is sick. These are the things to which we all as human beings are heir. But because we have a punishment culture, a punishment fetish in our culture, well, the grand jury's going to be impaneled in St. Louis County, and they'll deliberate on this one day a week from now till October. Does anybody have any confidence in that process? Last night, the news programs were all about how a sort of ping-pong game was being played between Governor Nixon and the prosecuting attorney of St. Louis County, with the prosecutor saying, well, Governor Nixon can remove me if he wants to, and Governor Nixon saying, nope, not going to do it. That's for him to determine. And it really is. It is for the prosecutor to determine. It is not a difficult process at all. And is even admirable when it's done. You put together a paper, you hand it to the judge, you say, Your Honor, I don't think I've got any business prosecuting this case. I work with a lot of these officers. And it would be best if a prosecutor came in who didn't, because I'm going to continue to have to work with these officers. Of course, that's a double-edged sword, because the cops might then look at him and say, hey, I thought you were on our side. You could have fixed this for us. By the way, the prosecuting attorney has announced that Officer Darren Wilson will be allowed to testify before the grand jury. It is highly unlikely that the actual witnesses to what Officer Wilson did will also be permitted to testify. And here's the fun part about grand juries. Nobody can do a damn thing about it. I don't know how many people they impanel on a grand jury in Missouri. 18, 20, 32, who knows? But a grand jury is supposed to be an inquiry by the members of the grand jury. In practice, in reality, it is not. There's an old saying out there that a prosecuting attorney can indict a ham sandwich with a grand jury if he so desires. The opposite of that is also true. If the prosecuting attorney does not want there to be a true bill, which is what an indictment is referred to when it is handed down by the grand jury, if the prosecutor doesn't want a true bill, the prosecutor can make that clear to the members of the grand jury as well. Like I said, Officer Professor Dutta got all smarmy on us because he closes saying, shouldn't the community members extend the same courtesy to their officers and project that the officer's safety is not threatened by their actions? Well, okay. But how many videos are there out there of citizens saying, why are you arresting me? Or why are you detaining me? Or why did you pull me over? With which they are met with abject hostility. Email coming in from Jim. He says, subject line, police behavior. A few times the police have given me a break. However, most have been arrogant, sometimes hateful, not even asking if they can help change a tire, as such is beneath their dignity. Not much public service is the same as activity for which they are paid. Sad state of affairs. Yeah. I can't tell you the number of times that I've walked past them, and, you know, I give them a, you know, nod, and a, hey, good afternoon. How you doing? Friendly guy. Most of the time, you get a scowl in return. A note coming in from our buddy, the Angry Indian. You may recall last week we had a wonderful conversation. With regard to Sanil Dutta, apparently Angry is familiar with him. Both he and Dinesh D'Souza, oh dear, I've got a Dinesh D'Souza story in the stacks too, if we can only get to it. Both he and Dinesh D'Souza are famous for being South Asians, fairly recently immigrating to North America, and fond of berating black people as if we are children. And both of these hypocritical individuals are paraded by the neoconservative right wing for understanding Europocentric racism better than Africans born and raised here under its laws, designed by Bible-thumping Christians, to ignore our basic humanity and its violence. Pick an anti-black knot of your choice. Angry says, where's the United Nations? Police abuse. Fred Williams tasered 5 times in chest. Dies in Gwinnett County. Yeah, it's getting a little embarrassing out there now. As an American, it's getting a little embarrassing out there now. What do I mean? Yesterday, yesterday, or the day before, Egypt, the nation of Egypt, issued a statement. Anybody? Tahrir Square? Cavalry charges on men and women and children? Rape? Anybody? Bueller? Egypt issued a statement urging the United States to use restraint. In the unsettlement of Ferguson, Missouri, Egypt. Egypt. Wow. And then, of course, there is the story, the account out there now, of how ISIS, ISIL, or just IS, has beheaded journalist James Foley. And I want to be really careful about this. President, not sure, has declared that justice will be done. This certainly seems like the kind of thing that could be, if one was very cynical and wished so to do, this could be the kind of thing that could whip an often atne ute aitbre, if you one what I mean may, nation into a killing frenzy. Because, of course, killing after a killing is, well, it's kind of that, it's the monotheistic way, isn't it? It's the Abrahamic way. Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, baby. Head for head. Yeah. Real easy to say, you know what we need to do? We need to go over there and give them the Carthage treatment. Kill them all. Glass them. You can almost hear the right wing saying it now, can't you? Men, women, children, beasts of the field, things that fly, walk, crawl, or swim, kill it all. I remember the other things remind me of things. There was a story a couple of weeks back coming out of the living hell that is the Middle East, goes back to July the 1st. It was reported from Haaretz via the Jewish Daily Forward it's difficult even to read. The only thing that can deter terrorists like those who kidnapped the children and killed them in Israel is the knowledge that their sister or their mother will be raped. This assertion was made by Middle East scholar Dr. Mordechai Kedar of Bar-Ilan University on an Israeli radio program. It sounds very bad, but that's the Middle East, he added. He is from Bar-Ilan's Department of Arabic, by the way. The program is called Hakol Diburim, which means apparently it's all talk. It aired in the immediate aftermath of this of the discovery, finally, of the three teenagers that the Israeli government already knew were dead. And the topic was how to deter Hamas, which prompted the following from Professor Kedar. You have to understand the culture in which we live. The only thing that deters is a threat to the connection between their heads and their shoulders. Now remember, this is not a member of the Islamic State saying this. Haaretz reports, when presenter Yossi Hadar asked if that could filter down the organization's ranks, Kedar replied, no, because lower down the considerations are entirely different. Terrorists like those who kidnap the children and kill them, the only thing that can deter them is if they know that their sister or their mother will be raped in the event that they are caught. What can you do? That's the culture in which we live. The host then said, we can't take such steps, of course. Professor Kedar added, I'm not talking about what we should or shouldn't do. I'm talking about the facts. The only thing that deters a suicide bomber is the knowledge that if he pulls the trigger or blows himself up, his sister will be raped. That's all. That's the only thing that will bring him back home in order to preserve his sister's honor. This guy gets to teach university students. Is that what it is? We just don't understand the culture? That we're not, for as brutal as we are, that we aren't brutal enough? Or is there another way? I don't necessarily know what that way is. But is there another way? How about disengaging over there and having nothing to do with the place? Oh, because oil. Because money. How about ceasing messing around in their affairs? I know that's going to sound a little isolationist, but it's also good manners, at least according to Mama. Mama was always big on mind your own business. Yeah. I don't know. Murderers, beheading journalists and threatening to do more in the Middle East, police waving guns at citizens in Ferguson, Missouri. I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. Breaking news via the New York Times, a United States Special Operations team tried and failed to rescue James Foley and other Americans held hostage in Syria during a secret mission this summer authorized by President Obama. This was announced just, well, not long ago. A day after Sunni militants posted a video showing Mr. Foley being beheaded, officials described what they called a complicated operation in which several dozen commandos were dropped into a remote area of Syria where American intelligence agencies believed several hostages were being held. But when the special operations team arrived on the scene, the hostages were not there. Officials said the commandos exchanged fire with the militants, and one American was slightly wounded when one of the United States aircraft came under fire. All the team members were evacuated successfully. It was not ultimately successful because the hostages were not present at the location of the operation. In other words, the so-called intel was no good. We obviously wish this had been successful. Officials declined to say exactly when the mission took place, saying only that it happened earlier this summer. They also would not provide the location of the mission, but noted that if it had taken place in or near a heavily populated area, it would have been likely to have been noticed before now. God Almighty. Tell you what. Back to the email box for a minute. Had a note. Had a note from Robert in Australia, and Robert said, "Sorry, Bob, I overslept. It's time for my regular 20th of the month up over down under challenge. I can afford to put $50 on the table today. I'd like for one person to match." Match it with $50, or five people with 10, or 50 people with $1 each. Actually, I'd like everyone who's listening to chip in a dollar. Thank you, Robert. In any combination. Thank you very kindly. So we've got 2 hours about to come up with some combination of $50 in order for Robert to double it. Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, yeah, that's you. How you doing?
I'm good, Jim. How are you?
Just listening to your monologue or your filibuster and just thinking about some of the experiences I've had with the police.
Well, I'm trying not to scream and carry on, but this is getting very frightening. On top of it all, there's one more story out there, Jim. According to the Los Angeles Times this morning, the LA Times followed some of the children that the right wing in this country demanded be sent back to Central America. Five, and possibly as many as seven, died upon their return to their homelands.
Well,
because that's what we sent them. That's what we sent them back into.
Yeah, Honduras, or someplace like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been down there, and I can assure you, it's not exactly one of the most desirable places in which to live. That's the damn sure, and I can understand why they would want to leave there and try to escape to a better life. That's just very sad. But, you know, if we could, for a minute or three, talk about some of the experiences with police, you might find them interesting.
Sure.
Oh, back in my wilder, less milder days, back in the days of the bong with the stirrups.
And the aquarium pump.
Yes, we got to give the power company their credit for helping me do it.
Amen. Absolutely.
No, but I remember a friend and I were driving. it was near the University of South Carolina, and we had been smoking dope in the car, and this cop pulled us over. I mean, it was our fault entirely. I mean, you could even see inside the car because the smoke was just so thick.
Colombian sauna.
You got it. And so the cop said, "Please roll down the window so I can see you." And so my friend did, and luckily the policeman, this is what he told me. He said, "You know, this is just damn stupid of you people, and I need to get home. And if I take you in, I'm going to have to write a hell of a report." And says to me, "Can you drive any better than he?" And I said, "Yes, sir." by that time, I had swallowed the whole thing, the doobie.
Oh, dear.
And I was damn lucky there.
A whole bunch of your life could have gone sideways in a hurry.
Yeah, it sure could have. And, you know, that taught me a bit, that taught me quite a lesson, to tell you the truth. Sure did. And I was real glad that cop just wanted to get home. I mean, sometimes your whole life and your whole career could just pivot on circumstance. I was lucky. I was glad to do it. And I learned a lesson, like I said before. But other experiences, like I said in my email with cops, have not been real pleasant. A funny thing happened to me on Halloween, and I was rear-ended by this fool. And, he was as drunk as the Lord. I was not. But had, you know, been, well, smoking again. But it was Halloween, why not?
Sure.
And this guy who lived there, near where it happened, said, "Y'all stay right there. I'm calling the police." And I looked at the guy who had rear-ended me, and I said, "Are you going to stay here?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, do you believe in the hereafter? Because you got to be here after I'm gone." And my ass was out of there damn quick. But later on, and, you know, as I began to sort of develop in my career and stuff, I was detailed to, when I was working at Fort Jackson, to set up a testing program for the police officers at the police academy there in Columbia. And the first, well, the genesis of the whole program that I was set up was to give them the test of adult basic education, which would determine their reading levels. And you talk about something that threatened them. I mean, when they found out what I was doing, those cops absolutely hated the ground I walk on. Because when I would give that test and, of course, run through the machine, a lot of them couldn't read at 8th grade level.
That's not inspiring, Jim.
No, and I also had to teach a class in how they were to write a report properly so it would stand up, you know, in court. A lot of them weren't able to do that. Very poor written skills, things of that nature. I won't even go into some of the language skills. You've already talked enough about that. But they felt extremely threatened. Because I was doing something that would eventually help them in their career progression and hopefully in the performance of their job. But it did not sit well. But that program is still in place today. And I was never so glad to get out of that place when I did. Because of the, you could just cut the hostility with a knife in the air. Because here was that guy that was going to come along and try to make me look stupid. Or illiterate, or whatever. And a lot of them are, and a lot of them were, and will continue to be.
Once upon a time, Jim, I was in a position where I had to routinely read things that police officers wrote.
Well, I bet you had a fun with that.
I don't like to. I mean, in my interpersonal relations, I don't like to try to belittle people or make them feel inadequate. But the situation was such that you'd look at these, and these were reports, you know, B&Es, burglaries, pot busts. I mean, and you'd say, you can't turn it in like that.
Well, that's what I tell them. You know, I give them practice runs on situations and stuff like that. And I would just try to explain to them on an individual basis where they had made a mistake. And you could just see the smoke coming out of their ears, literally, or the steam, whatever. They don't like to be corrected.
No.
They don't like to be told, "Look, buddy, what you've done is wrong." And it's, you know, because, and I guess in there, one told me, he said, you're just trying to make me look stupid. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm trying to help you do your job. So when you get a case that needs to be processed and, you know, configured properly in a court of law, you're not going to look like an idiot. I don't think I got a lot of thankful vibes from him then, that's for sure.
Well, I was going to say, did that get through? I mean...
Did it get through?
Yeah, I mean...
The program stood and is still in place today. And that was back in, oh God, 83, I think.
Is it, I guess what I'm asking is the program treated as a valid part of training, or is it a hoop that must be jumped through?
Valid part of training, as well as a hoop that must be jumped through. I mean, the two are the same. In other words, you have to read above an 8th grade level before you can be certified. And, of course, I used to get shit from a lot of police chiefs who would say, well, he's my best officer. It ain't his fault he can't read right. And I used to have to fight that, too. Like I say, I was glad as hell to get out of there.
Oh, I can imagine.
And I'll tell you one more story, and I'll let you go. I was speeding my old 5 miles over the limit, and this policeman pulled me over. And I said, okay, here it comes. The old Bohicus. I was back, you know, there it is. Here goes 4 points. Yeah, 4 points. And he said to me, he said, now, if you want to come to court and contest this, you'll have to come to court on this date. And I said, yes, sir. He said, I've got to go for my 2 weeks National Guard training. And I said, okay, that's fine. And I thought to myself, thank you, Jesus. Because I went to court. He couldn't be there. And the case was thrown out.
Yeah. Did he refile?
No, he didn't, thankfully. I mean, I guess he could have asked for a continuation or whatever. I mean, you know, I was fixed to go in and ask for a continuation, and I was thinking about this all the time, but when he gave me the dates when he would be gone, I said, well, you know, this is a good time for me to see if he possibly, because of his absence, could lose his case by default. And it was so ordered. So I kept my 4 points, and I sure avoided that guy because he was awfully upset when he got back.
I can well imagine.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of other stories, too. Good Lord in heaven. But like I say, you've got these guys out there. I guess they consider themselves to be the new Centurions. As a matter of fact, I think they have a movie called that.
Yeah, there was. Oh, who wrote that?
I don't know, but it was, I didn't see it, but I heard about it. And of course, you know, you've got a lot of cops who are, a lot of police officers who are, as you said before, just very unfriendly. And if you're in a bad situation, like you've blown a tire on an interstate or something like that, they won't even offer to help you do anything. I mean, to put you out of imminent danger of being rear-ended by another vehicle. I mean, no matter how closely you pull off on the side of the road, because a lot of times on these roads, there ain't a whole lot of shelter there. You know what I'm saying?
No. There are places on, you know, federal interstate highway here in West Virginia, not far from Beckley, right after you get onto, go through the Turnpike toll booth.
Bingo.
Where there is no shoulder at all.
Oh, we're going the other way toward those tolls. That's a trip to have a flat tire on, that's for sure. And I was on I-77 just having come out of one of those tunnels and blew a tire. And the only person who stopped was a guy driving a 18-wheeler. So, I mean, you know, it's just amazing where you find friends in the civilian population who are paid nothing.
Oh, we had back in the days of the rusty red pickup truck before the local pillhead sent it to its long home. I had a fuel pump that was failing, and going down the road, you know, you're at highway speed, 65, 70 miles an hour, and I think Agnes and I were on our way to a doctor's appointment or something, and we were on that stretch of the turnpike that has no shoulder. And rusty red pickup just quit. And I mean, there was a semi behind us barreling down on us. Doing 70 if not more. And there was not I put on the flashers and there wasn't a damn thing I could do. And I just looked at Agnes and said, "Love you. Been nice knowing you." And at the last minute, that semi just popped into the next lane and blew on.
Yeah, I've had experiences very similar to that. But, you know, going back to the police officers and stuff like that, there's a lot to be desired in their conduct and their behavior. And on this thing with Hamas, and this is something I just want to share with you. I was listening to Don Imus this morning, and he has this lady on there who was a national security advisor under Nixon, Reagan, Nixon, Ford, and Reagan, and K.T. McFarland. And she's a smart damn lady. She was talking about the situation in Southwest Asia. And she was her civil service rank was the equivalent of a 3-star general.
Wow.
Smart lady. And she said this morning, she said, "We should have never been over there in the first place under Bush and under Obama since we were there. We may have pulled out too soon." She said, "It's damned if we do and damned if we don't."
I agree with that assertion, Jim. I don't think we pulled out too soon because I don't think there was ever a right time to pull out. And I say that because there was never a right time to go in.
Well, that's what she said too. And her advice was the only thing she could offer from her vast amount of expertise was to arm the hell out of the Kurds. Because those Kurds, and these were her own words, are almost as well trained and as good a fighter as a Navy SEAL. But she said under no circumstances should there be any more boots on the ground or whatever.
And yet a nation is, because, you know, it doesn't take any divination or a peach tree branch or anything to figure this out. The beheading of an American journalist is going, I'm sure the right wing is absolutely going mad right now with bloodlust. And following on the heels of that, they will say, of course, that Barack Obama's a big old sissy man, and he's a secret Muslim who doesn't want to, and he doesn't want to attack people who are his ideological allies. You know, they'll argue that he is, you know, part. I mean, they've already accused him of being in the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, how hard is it going to be for him to say, "No, actually, he's a member of the Islamic State too"?
But even though she is a Fox News national security contributor, now she basically is not assigned to Fox, but comes into the green room as an advisor and is on some programs like Don Imus. Even she said, "When was the last beheading? Was it today?"
I saw the news yesterday. Did they do another one today?
They may have, and Don asked her, "What would the fate of these people be?" And she said, "They will lose their heads. There's no question about it." And interestingly enough, I heard from another source about Hamas that a lot of Hamas leaders have their headquarters way down in some little emirate on the Persian Gulf, and they're not up there in Gaza. So they're not in the line of fire. So it's kind of easy for them to make a lot of statements. I hope they can get that situation resolved there. I don't know if the ceasefire is still in effect or not. I hope it is, because it's been pretty terrible what's been happening. But anyways, that's just a few things that I have to contribute. Not a whole lot. Just experience with the police and what I've heard today. And I have a lot of respect for this lady, though. I really do. I really do. She hit it right on the head.
I forget. Are you any kind of an old Star Trek fan at all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you know what the Kobayashi Maru is. You know, that was the...
I vaguely remember Kobayashi Maru. It sounds like a Japanese tanker in World War II, but
No, the Kobayashi Maru test was the no-win situation that was used for all up-and-coming Starfleet Academy students, cadets,
okay,
whatever.
Okay.
Midshipmen.
Okay.
And James Kirk famously was the only one to beat the Kobayashi Maru, and it turned out that he did it by cheating.
I vaguely remember that.
But the reason I go through all that is to say that you know, the situation is in Iraq is a 21st century Kobayashi Maru for any president, because there is no correct answer.
Not really. And another thing she brought out this morning, too, was what these people don't realize, and she referred to them, and these were in her words, what these neocons fail to realize and refuse to realize even now, that we are not in the business of nation building. We're not.
I get what you're saying. I'm trying to come up with the right way to respond, and that is to say, and I think what I want to say is, no, but we proved ourselves quite adequate at nation destroying, and we should not be surprised by the vacuum, or by what gets sucked into the vacuum that we create.
Well, that's exactly the point she was trying to make, Bob. That's exactly the point she was trying to make. Because if, you know, you broke it, you fix it. And
yeah, that's the famous Colin Powell Pottery Barn rule.
Right, the Pottery Barn rule. But I was every time I see or hear her on TV, I always sit up and take notice, because I have a lot of respect for this lady. And I wish that, well, some of the people high in, you know, who were her bosses would have realized exactly what she advised them to do and what not to do. You know, it's kind of like when you advise a president, and this was, I think, advice maybe given to, Henry VIII back when he was on his rampage and stuff. You should tell a king what he should do, not what he can do.
And never what he must do.
Well, just can do, right, there it is, and you know. And that's basically it. Because once you tell him, you know, what, you know, he can do with limitless powers, you've just unleashed a lion cage or a cage containing a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You should tell him what he should do, not what he can do. And the same advice should be given to presidents and stuff like that. I wish they had been given to Bush. I'm sure they were. But
oh, no, that advice was given to Bush. It was given to Bush by anybody who could get his ear. And he didn't want to hear it. There was a pathology. Because that's, I mean, when there's a pathology at work and not a thought process, all the advice and all the good advice in the world is worth nothing.
Well, that's very true. Absolutely. And he did what he wanted to do. And now we're paying for it still. He stabilized the entire country, entire part of the world, and I'll tell you, it's going to come back and bite us right in the ass, too.
And what I've always argued with regard to our Middle Eastern adventures is that these things don't bite the asses of the people who create the problem.
Mm-mm.
They bite people who have nothing to do with the problem whatsoever. And because of the way things work, there are grudges that will be carried on for 500, 1,000 years now over there.
Yeah.
I mean, if folks in the south of the United States are marching in Jackson or in Oxford, Mississippi, demanding that the Confederate flag be used, and saying that the University of Mississippi was a Confederate university, and that's 150 years ago, and we're still doing that foolishness. Imagine the heat of a vendetta that's had 500 years to simmer.
Well, your point is well noted. Also, this lady, K.T. McFarland, said there are 300 members of the ISI who bear American passports.
That's the Pakistani secret police.
I'm not sure she did.
You mean ISIS, ISIL, IS?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
ISIS. I mean, sometimes I hear them call ISA or ISIS or whatever. I said, you know, you're referring to the Egyptian goddess. I didn't know exactly, you know, what's going on
here.
But there are 300 of them that bear American passports and 2,700 of them who bear various European passports, which indicate these people have free access to come and go as they please into either this country or to...
I want to be clear on that, though, Jim. An American passport indicates American citizenship, does it not?
It does.
I mean, if you are a green card foreign national, you've still got your country's passport, right?
She said they were American citizens who had gone over to fight with this group. And as a corollary to that, said bearing American passports and 2,700 bearing European passports, giving them carte blanche entry into respective countries.
Yeah.
That's
unsettling. But if we
it is unsettling.
But by the same token, if I have to ask you, if we know that there are 300 American passports being held by people who are members of Islamic State, then doesn't that mean we know who they are? Shouldn't that mean that there's an alert list and sorry, you know?
Effectively, but, you know, passports can be forged. They can be manipulated. And we all know the history behind that.
Oh, doubtless.
And they sure, so that was part of her dialogue this morning. But listen, you've got other callers you want to talk to. So I will say have a good one, have a nice hump day, and aloha.
Aloha. Book 'em, Dano.
Right, whatever. Take care.
All right, see you, Jim. Bye.
Good night.
Our buddy Jim calling from not too terribly far from here. So lines are open, 304-574-8178. Remember, please, we're a little over halfway through the end of the program, or through a little less than halfway to the end of the program. And we have Robert's up over down under challenge on the table. Robert is looking for someone to match his $50 challenge. If someone comes up with 50 bucks or 2 at 25, 5 at 10, 10 at 5, 50 at 1, or as Robert suggests, every single person listening to this program, kick in a dollar, whatever the combination, Robert will match the 50 that comes in, which would be a distinct, net positive. And thank you, Sal, for getting us started this evening. It is very much appreciated, the constancy that Sal displays. Let's see. I think we got Texas. I mean, this is a rarity. We've got Texas Betsy on the line. Hey, Betsy.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Pretty good. Got your smelling salts out?
I don't need them.
Okay.
I've known for 3 days I wanted to call in. So, I don't know how many of the Horn family know me, but I assume most of them.
Yes.
I work for a middle school, and we've started getting a lot more refugees, which this school has never had before. And we're up to 9 from 2 last year, which is only going to go up. But one of the things that I started doing was collecting school supplies and participating in school supply drives. And I found something out, which you probably know, that I had never seen this statistic before, and it makes a huge difference, in my opinion, about some of the achievement gap that is out there, at least maybe a piece of the achievement gap that's out there between students who are high needs, high economic, low-income students and middle-class students, assuming that there are middle-class people left in America. Anyway, one of the things is that, and this is higher at my school district, but if somebody who is working, an adult who is working minimum wage, has to work 7.8 hours, according to the Department of Labor, to pay for the school supplies for an average third grader. And I know that my district, that's even higher. And then consider that, but then consider how many people have 2 or 3, or like you years ago, 4 kids in school at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about an entire week's wages that are not going for rent or food, they're just going for school supplies.
And one, I didn't know that. 2, I find it shocking. I also find it appalling.
I completely find it appalling.
Let's ask a question. In civilized countries, do parents have to provide the necessary school supplies, or is it enough for parents to feed their children and get them on the bus in the morning?
In civilized countries, they could even eat breakfast at school, but yes, in civilized countries, this only school supplies used at home are required. I don't know about your daughter's school, but here, as a teacher, the school where I am right now does not even give me staples or tape or a whiteboard eraser or markers for the whiteboard. We either buy it out of pocket or we get parents to send it in. So I'm sure that over the years you've had to send for your kids. Well, I mean, you tell me, did you ever have to send Kleenex? Did you ever have to send?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it used to be when I first started teaching, the schools provided all of that.
I can remember, Betsy, and I promise I'm not going to drag everybody down memory lane. But I remember, you know, I remember being a first grader. And I remember the teacher buying for everyone in the classroom. Of course, when I got home, and told my parents, you know, not like I was ratting anybody out, but the teacher had brought in a little, you know, those little like purse size packages of Kleenex.
So you could all have one at your seat.
Yes. And everybody got one. So the next day I went in with, you know, however much the dime or whatever it cost. And I don't know who else did, but had, you know, in the school system in which I grew up, had the teacher waited for that to be paid for out of school funds, well, we would all just sat there with our noses running.
Right.
And that was first grade. And it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
But back then, there were art supplies provided. You know, remember the heavy color, the really heavy duty coloring paper?
Right.
You know, just blank paper. It had kind of a beige color to it.
It's called, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
But I don't know if any of us knew who was buying how much. Because I remember one teacher who was very detail oriented, and I adored her, telling us about a local business across the river, and she said, everything you need is there. And it is of professional educational quality. I remember that phrase, professional educational quality. But I also remember when I started school, Betsy, there was no air conditioning. You know, can you imagine? Yeah, you can. You're in Austin.
I taught in New York, so we moved here in 98. When I taught in New York, we did not have air conditioning there in 98.
Well, North Alabama is not just a whole lot cooler than Austin, Texas. And starting school in August in North Alabama in an unair-conditioned school was hell. And you know how that school got air conditioned? The parents chipped in and chipped in and chipped in, you know, whoever could, however they could, to purchase air conditioners. I remember, and you know how Bible Belty Alabama is. I remember when parents showed up over the course of 2 days on a Saturday and a Sunday. And painted the classrooms.
They did that here. They painted the outside of the portables. I don't know. I want to say last February. The parents and students and teachers.
Do parents have to go? And again, I ask this non-rhetorically. Do parents have to go and paint the classrooms in Sweden or Germany or Norway or Finland? You know, Finland, home of the best teachers on earth, you know, we're told.
So when I was in Germany, the classrooms were really ugly and not decorated and not hadn't been painted in years. Just saying. And that was 99, maybe? Somewhere out there.
Yeah. So maybe some civic... And there's a line here. I mean, I, when you've got parents who are willing to go and do stuff in their children's schools, I think you have... that means you have an involved group of parents, which is always a super net double plus good in an educational setting, right?
Yes.
But all parents can't participate the same way. And all parents can't necessarily afford the same stuff.
Right. And that's actually the email that I sent you, I don't know, while you were talking to Jim, we as teachers, I think, I'm at a school that for the last 5 years since my son left it has become less upper middle class and more poverty than it's ever been.
Why? What's the reason behind that?
They changed the which schools we draw from. That's a big part. We actually draw from an East Austin elementary as well as the three West Austin elementaries we've always drawn from. That's part of it. Part of it is that, you know, we live in what has been Republican hell for years, and there are way more have-nots than haves anymore. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what else, but so we're not a Title I school, but we are within about 2 or 3 percentage points on free and reduced lunch of becoming a Title I school. But we don't have that funding, and yet we're starting to have those needs. It's actually a good part of why they hired me, is because all of my, prior to this, all but 1 year of my professional experience was at high needs schools, not just with high needs populations.
Do the people in the school sense that and know that and what?
Yes,
what
really understand what that means.
Well, I was going to say, what does that feel like then?
So, for me, it feels like that I'm often educating people about our kids, which was the whole purpose of the email. I did not email you, just so people know. I emailed the staff and CC'd or blind copied you. I hope it was blind. So I had a very rude awakening my very first year teaching in Chicago, and this was my first year with my own classroom. And I had first grade, and there was this, I still remember this very vividly, it was very, very high crime, high poverty neighborhood. And I had done some work in East Baltimore, which is in a very high crime neighborhood, but it wasn't my classroom. I didn't really have a sense of what things were. And I got to Chicago and I was teaching a social studies lesson to first graders, and it was about safety and keeping safe. And I read the question just as it was in the curriculum guide, you know, tell about some things that you can do to keep yourself or your family safe. And on the curriculum guide, it had, you know, it was like a teacher's guide. It had suggested answers that the kids might say, holding hands to cross the street, or looking both ways to cross the street, or holding hands in a parking lot, and things like this. And my kids wrote about pretending they were dead if shots were fired. And they were in first grade. And it was then that I decided, and this got me in trouble that year that I taught in Pflugerville, I decided right then and there that I don't teach textbooks, I teach children.
Well, amen.
Well, yeah. Because the experience of my kids did not match what the book was written for. I would say a good 2/3, 3/4 of my colleagues at this middle school who are excellent teachers have absolutely no idea what the life of any of our kids is. Of 20%, 30% of our kids is really like. They don't they don't understand that to go from a day when we have all classes to a day when they have half of their classes. So there's no, the chances of having a, that's the time where they're less likely to have a study hall between one class and the next.
Does that 20 or 30?
If they can't decide something that requires internet access.
Does that 20 or 30% skew along ethnic or racial or class lines?
All of the above.
Because there was a fascinating article published by Time that was authored by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he writes. I think you can almost say he writes as well as he played basketball, and that's, you know, pretty darn good.
Yeah.
But he said that we will not understand what he called it. He said it was titled like "The Coming Race War," and that phrase is so loaded. But he wasn't advocating or anything, of course. He said the reason we will not understand it is because it will not be about race as much as it is about class.
Right.
And we don't comprehend class. Because, of course, all you have to do is ask David Barton over there at Wall Builders, you know, Glenn Beck's buddy, and he'll tell you, this is a classless society.
Right.
But it sounds to me like it's a, but you know, you're not teaching in a classless school, are you?
Absolutely not. You know, my son maintains, and I believe him, that in his advanced classes, whether it was IB or AP or pre-AP, that in the advanced classes, he never had a black classmate. He only had a black classmate in his regular classes or in PE and electives and film and things like that. And he went through this system. I teach at the school that he attended. I have absolutely no reason to doubt him.
Oh, nor do I doubt your account or that reality. The question, you know, the real torment out of this, though, is, well, I mean, you described your experience in Chicago, but is this a national question or is this worse in the Texases and the Alabamas and the Mississippis?
If we're talking class, I would say it's got to be the same everywhere.
You don't think it's more entrenched in the old Confederacy? Or more clearly drawn?
I don't know. The only place that I've lived in the old Confederacy is in the Blue Dot.
Yeah. Well, okay, true enough. Austin is not dime box.
No. So I don't know that I could address that. But I do know that even in when I taught at East Austin, I had a kid who, you know, was getting in trouble at lunch every day. And a lot of what he was getting in trouble for was taking two trays and stealing stuff and all of this, but he only ever got in trouble at lunch. And when teachers would complain about him, I was the only one to say, well, is he eating at home? And not only did people not have an answer, which is fine, nobody else had asked the question. And, you know, at that point...
Did they at least think the question relevant?
Yes. Once I asked the question, everybody sort of put their hand on their head and said, well, you've got all five of the kids from that family. Can you find out? And I said, absolutely. And no, they were not eating dinner. And so all of a sudden, it's
was
not
that, okay? Okay, can we drill down for a second? Were they not eating dinner because of poverty or neglect?
Largely poverty. So there were a whole lot of issues in that house. Poverty being one of the big ones. I also had a student who was not eating dinner, whose mother would have been perfectly happy for them to get help from, quote, the church where people ate dinner. Because when I asked one of the girls in that family, did you eat dinner last night? Are you going to eat dinner tonight? She said, oh, we always eat dinner on Tuesdays. We eat at church. And they give us clothes, too. I'm like, okay, I know what kind of, you know, I don't know what church, but I, you know, I get that. And then I had another kid who wanted to know, and this was the Tuesday before a 3-day Thanksgiving vacation, whether on the days that the school was closed for classes, was it at least open for breakfast and lunch? To which the answer was no.
Oh, God.
Ended up having a conversation with her mother, and I said, do you know about this church? At that point, I knew, on Georgian Place, the church at the corner that has, you know, food. And she said, I can't let my 14-year-old daughter walk. I work nights, and I can't let my 14-year-old daughter walk to that church and back after dark.
Well, you got a note in from Tamara in Southern California. And she said, I can say from experience that Texas Betsy's experience in Texas is identical in California. So, in other words, it's a national problem.
It is a national problem.
Dare we say it is a national shame?
Absolutely.
And is it okay if we get a mite frustrated with the people who declare that, you know, we don't need school lunches, that mommy, you know, what's happened to them? It's the nanny state. And why can't mommy make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich like I had when I walked to school clothed in my white privilege uphill both ways through 6 feet of snow? It built character.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when Russia, I would
tell them to go read what Cassie wrote, I don't know how many years ago, about her empty lunchbox.
Yeah.
You know, walk into school with an empty lunchbox.
And I forget what seminar or teaching or whatever we want to call it that I was at, where I first heard about these programs, and I know you've participated in them, where when you're going to have a long weekend or any weekend, people, you know, brown bag, you know, what was it called? Backpack? Brown bag,
yeah,
backpack?
I don't remember what it was called, but, yeah, so I had one student last year who, before long weekends and before holidays, for a two-week break for the 3 or 4 days before the holiday, she brought an extra backpack home every day that had groceries for the family.
And this is, of course, a country that has cut back on food assistance to somewhere around $1 a day.
Right. So in that, just so you know, in my class last year, I believe either 90 or 95% of my kids were on free lunch. And she was the only one who was so poor that she got a backpack.
Jeremy in Vermont noting the school system here, and that's Vermont, okay? Vermont, progressive, civilized Vermont. The school system here has the same issues as well. I remember kids back in the 90s when I was in school that only ate at school and over breaks. Who knows? And I was going to mention a moment ago, do you remember that clip from Rush Limbaugh maybe a year ago or more where he said the problem is that children have not been taught dumpster diving?
Yes. I do. It was more than a year.
Because, see, Betsy, I try real hard not to let myself engage in hate because, as I've tried to teach, Agnes and I have tried to teach our children, hate does more damage to the person doing the hating than the person being hated. But it really challenges my ability not to do that. When I think of a guy making $55 million a year suggesting that poor children need to go wading through the filth of a dumpster in order to get a decent meal.
Or be their school's only custodians. So I have no problem. Every kid in my class is responsible for keeping my classroom clean. That's just part of how I teach. You know, we all have jobs, and some of us do wash tables, and some of us do take out trash, and some of us, and those jobs rotate. That's not the same thing as singling out the kids who are on free lunch to do those jobs.
And then Tamara just interjected. She said, kids know how to dumpster dive. I see it every day.
Wow.
And can we, you know, when you and I first talked about having this conversation, because you very politely, you know, said, I don't want to jump into the middle of, because the stuff in Ferguson is so compelling and so just, you know,
right, searing.
But I don't necessarily see this and Ferguson, and maybe it's because I need to get out the Thorazine dart self-administration blowgun again. It's kind of U-shaped. I don't see them as separate issues. Do you see why I would say that?
I do. I think that, so, on the one hand, I do and I don't. So I do see them as being the same because it is about the demonization of the impoverished and the, you know, I actually saw a, quote, liberal put up recently that if people want to earn more than $7.75 an hour, they should get a job at minimum wage, work really hard like I did, and earn their raises. Most of them aren't even worth the $7.75. There's that, and this is from a guy who at least recent, you know, 5 years ago was liberal. I don't know what on earth happened to him.
I've got a post here from Politicus USA by Justin Barragona pointing to the fact that, you remember Joe the plumber who isn't Joe and isn't a plumber,
yes,
and is really named Samuel Wurzelbacher?
Oh, I saw that, yes.
He has decided to unlimber himself of his thinking regarding what's going on in Ferguson. And he said one way to stop rioting and looting in Ferguson would be to hold a job fair. Why? Because people would scatter like cockroaches when the lights come on. And then he posted a photograph of some boots, and he said, it's interesting that one of the items not being looted in Ferguson is work boots.
All right. Where did you say we're keeping the hockey pucks right now?
Yeah, I know. I should have warned people, shouldn't I? But this is all dog whistle code.
Yes.
Everybody knows.
So I remember the story. I thought he said scatter to the winds, but scatter like cockroaches is worse.
Yeah, because he just called the people who live in Ferguson, Missouri, who are upset about the homicide of an unarmed 18-year-old young man. He just called them cockroaches, Betsy.
Right. And, you know, these people can't not call other people animals.
And there's a backstory to Ferguson, too. that I just ran across today that is absolutely fascinating. Well,
can I, before you go there, I answer the other half of your question?
Yes, absolutely.
So I said that I agree and I disagree. So the possibly disagree part is I want to know what we know the racial breakdown of the police force in Ferguson. I would like to know what the racial and class breakdown of the staff at the schools is. But even that, I'm not sure will tell us anything because I grew up very upper middle class. And look where I ended up. I'm possibly more sensitive on my campus than a lot of the people who grew up in poverty. So, you know, I don't know that that necessarily tells you something, but I would like to know how many of the teachers in the schools in Ferguson are ridiculing, and I heard this last year, of a teacher basically ridiculing the children who didn't bring the right number of dividers. Dividers are cheap.
Yeah,
I'd be much more concerned about some of the other school supplies than the dividers. But if that kind of stuff is going on in Ferguson, then this is the same story. But I don't know that that is. I would not want to guess. It's going on at my school because these are teachers who have been at the school for 30 years, who are remembering the classes from 5, 10, 15 years ago.
What's going to happen to that school when they start retiring, Betsy?
It's improving already.
Oh, it's going to get better?
When those teachers start retiring, yes.
Okay, yeah.
Because those teachers, there are a few who spend, some of them are very good teachers in many ways, but they're also very set in their ways, and a few of them will cluck as often as you're willing to listen about how much more prepared the kids were 10 years ago.
Okay, I can see all that.
This principle is also very enlightened in regards to these issues. Now, she's also the one who wore the T-shirt last year that she got in China that compared Obama to Mao. So,
mercy.
But when it comes to kids, she's enlightened.
Well, I wanted...
None of us are good at every issue.
Well, no, and, you know, for all have sinned and yada, yada, yada. I wanted to address kind of where you were going about, you know, differences. Yes, it is, but no, it's not. Because I ran across something earlier today that offers a little bit of background and perhaps a little bit of insight into how Ferguson became Ferguson. And it's a story of the deliberate depopulation of what had been a successful minority-majority community in North St. Louis County. It was called Kinloch, K-I-N-L-O-C-H. And it was razed. It was deliberately depopulated, absolutely destroyed for airport expansion. And there's a lot of people who are still very bitter about that, and many of the people who were depopulated, removed, if you will, went to Ferguson. The Al Jazeera article I'm looking at says, in 1980, more than 4,000 people lived in Kinloch. Today there are not even 300, and the entire municipality has been reduced to less than 1 square mile of land, drained of most of its tax base. What used to be streets lined with houses, churches, and corner stores now resemble an undeveloped plot of land sprinkled with decaying buildings and cracked, empty streets. Much of the land belongs now to the city of St. Louis. Nearly the entire town was torn down to accommodate a runway that, in the end, was never built. The ground shakes when landing planes pass over, an ironic homage to the fact that the city's first airstrip was in Kinloch, a point of pride for many of its former residents. What they did in Kinloch was destroy the sense of community there. That's from a man named Tony Ambus. And so, you know, we can see in that that, and I guess what I'm suggesting here, Betsy, is that the degradation of schools, the because we're degrading the schools at the same time we are upgrading, militarizing the police. We're degrading the schools at the same time that we are building more prisons. If you actually want less prison population, aren't you better off building more schools?
I heard a statistic at a literacy workshop today that the way that they predict how many prison beds a community is going to need in whatever number of years is looking at the literacy scores of third graders.
Third graders?
Third graders. That if they don't make that jump, so there's a big jump that happens between learning to read in K-1, 2, and 3 and reading to learn from fourth grade on. If a kid doesn't make that jump successfully, that is the biggest predictor of prison population.
I guess that's, is it appropriate to say shocking?
But apparently state planners, that's what they use.
So doesn't that mean that one should really, really bear down on K through 3?
One would think. But even every school district ever in the United States spends far more money at high school than it does at elementary.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I almost despair. Because it seems like, because these strike me as eminently solvable problems, Betsy.
So it's interesting. I was thinking about Chicago today and about solving problems by thinking outside of the box. And I was involved in two programs in Chicago that did not close the achievement gap, but certainly went a huge way towards making ours one of the most successful elementary campuses in the city. One of them was called the Bottomless Fruit Bowl, where in the cafeteria, you couldn't do this after 9/11, but the cafeteria was open not only to students every morning, but to parents and other family members. And so you had the entire community hanging out in the cafeteria, eating fruit and baked goods every morning. And parents would come and they'd bring the 2-year-old and they'd bring grandma and they'd, you know, everybody would. But it also meant, and the purpose of it was not just family nutrition, the purpose of that was so that if a teacher needed to talk to a student's family, you pretty much knew where you could find somebody at 7 a.m. And the families felt welcome in the school. For the cost of bananas.
Bananas.
Bananas. And cheapest, most bang for your buck intervention that is not drill and kill test scores. It's getting parents comfortable being in the building, feeling welcome, being welcome, and, oh, the teacher stops by to grab an orange on her way to class and gets to sit and talk to so-and-so's mother.
You know, I actually know, Betsy, what that... You just said something very important, feeling comfortable in the building.
Well, for parents who... And I shocked a bunch of people yesterday when I told them that in my writing class last year, and my writing class is for kids who, by and large, who are long-term English language learners. Two who were newer, who didn't fit in the other writing class. But the purpose of my class was to teach the long-term English language learners. In my class, over half of my kids had parents who never went to high school. Of those who never went to high school, three never finished second grade, and one mom had never been to school. That is the context for how comfortable are these parents being in school for any reason. Especially parents who, and then of course for mine, not a single parent of anyone in the room had gone to school in the United States. Because otherwise they wouldn't be in my room. But that kind of thing is part of this not achievement gap, but family, involvement gap. If you're a parent who can't read, and perhaps your child was born here, but your immigration status is not completely kosher, and maybe you were not successful, maybe the reason that your brother or sister got to finish ninth grade and you only got to finish sixth grade is because you were not successful in school, how many parent conferences are you going to attend if there's not some way of making you feel like school wants you there and that this is, you know, not just your obligation, but your right and, you know, that we want you there. My school has busing. And the PTA, I mean, thank goodness, is paying for our after-school bus. So the regular school bus at 3:30 is paid for by the city. The 5 o'clock after-tutoring, after-sports bus is paid for by the PTA. There is no bus after concerts or after football games. And that affects who participates in, you know, I had a lot of kids last year who were really, really excited about playing an instrument for the first time until they missed their second concert and were now, could not get higher than a 75 in orchestra. I would be surprised if any of those kids are in orchestra again the second year.
And after all, it's only music, right?
Oh, we've got a great music program. But what we don't necessarily have, so with it, our Vietnamese ESL teacher, so guy who has my job but who's paid for with funds that are following kids from the Vietnamese bilingual program in through ESL in the middle school years, he will drive, he has parents sign releases. He has every kid he teaches, every kid at the Vietnamese after school activities sign a release that he can transport their child. And he gets a much greater participation because if a kid or a parent says to him, oh, but I want to do this, but my parents are working and they can't pick me up, he will go to those events and he will drive them home.
So
that needs to be, it's great that he's willing to do that. We need a more systemic solution. It's the problem of not having neighborhood schools.
Yeah.
The kids in the neighborhood, my son walked to the school and walked back.
That was my experience for the first 6 grades. I walked 3 blocks to school, 3 blocks back. Now, granted, you know, things being what they are, sometimes I had to fight my way to school and fight my way back, but, you know, that's just the, you know, social dynamic, I guess. But neighborhood schools are the hub around which the spokes of the neighborhood turn.
Right. So that school in Chicago, most of those parents lived within 4 blocks, which is why they all showed up for breakfast. The other thing that we had at that school was something that I participated in, which was called Families Reading Together. And here the cost of the entire program was a bunch of beanbag chairs for the library and one book per student per month and one meal per event, one meal per month for however many people showed up. And what that program involved was the parents coming in and having a demonstration lesson, not you should read to your kids, but here's the difference between reading to your child and reading with your child, where there's give and take and there's questions and there's answers and there's further discussion and there's all kinds of things that happen more in middle-class college-educated homes than happen in non-college-educated homes. And that program was wildly successful, that we saw to some degree with our first and second graders, but where we really saw it was when their brothers and sisters came to first grade, when their younger siblings came to first grade.
Because they had a pre-existing well of experience?
Yes, because the parents, when they were reading to one in a small house, you can't read to one without having the other one climb up and ask their own questions. And you're modeling, and you're also teaching the older one, who's only in second grade, how to read aloud to the next one when they're in third and first, or third and pre-K. And so that was something that we saw when I got to that school. It was in year 4. And the difference between our incoming first graders and the incoming first graders who were now in 5th was tremendous in terms of preparedness to read. Again, a really low-cost program.
Yeah. No, it's, again, for what? How many similar programs could be run on, say, the cost of one up-armored personnel carrier for the St. Louis County Police Department?
You could probably run those two programs in the entire state of Missouri, I would think.
Then what does that say about our willingness to have the one but not the other? You follow?
Yes. Yeah, I really do. I mean, I think that we have to be willing to do what gets parents there. We have to be willing to do what. So the same thing, the parents came, I'm sure the first time, some of those parents came because there was going to be pizza and salad. I'm sure. They did not come because they wanted somebody to teach them how to read with their children.
They wanted food.
They came for dinner. But they kept coming back. And clearly they were taking these things home.
So
the first book we sent home with every child had no words. they were wordless books where even if you can't read or you can't read in the same language as your child or you can't read at all, you can read this book. Because we're all just talking about the pictures and trying to make a coherent story out of the book. Whoever came up with that idea was brilliant. I don't know where that one came from, but that was the first book of the year.
Let me ask you, Betsy. I think most of us know that Texas is somewhat unique in that its legislature only meets once every 2 years.
Correct.
And I don't know what the Texas Teachers Organization does, but I don't know what the interface is with the Texas Board of Education. But we're constantly hearing stories in the media about how the Texas School Book Authority wants to make sure that everybody understood that Adam and Eve rode to church on a dinosaur.
Correct.
Where. And it, by way of caveat, it also seems like every kind of decent right is under assault in Texas. But what happens if you go to the legislature and you tell them about a program like this?
I don't know. So I have
fund it.
I have a friend who's running for school board in Austin, and I'm planning to sit down with her and talk about all of this before the candidates form. I gotta start small.
Hopefully that. Well, maybe you can. Maybe it will begin a dialogue. But I guess, like I said earlier, I kind of despair. I don't know. I don't know if most of this country wants the same things that you, me, and the Horn Family Commune congregation want. Any impression, any idea, any thought?
I don't know. I mean, I think we talk a good game. Honestly, I think we've been Fox Newsed out of wanting our kids to be well-educated. You know, it's reading is one of those elite things.
I desperately don't want to believe that.
Well, I mean, look at, you know, before Fox News, there was the Reader Digest, and then from there to USA Today. We've been dumbing down America for a very long time.
And this is not a road that goes anywhere nice, Betsy.
No.
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 So, you know, I applaud your efforts and the efforts of those who do similar things, but there's going to have to be an attitude change in this country, and I'd like to know, or I'd like to hope it can happen, but I would like even better to know how it can happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, awareness has to be the first step. You know, just knowing why it is that some kids are coming to school with just a pencil and a spiral. To me, I believe in acting locally. I there are very small things that I can do that might make a difference. And that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to, you know, call you and talk about some of the bigger ones on the radio, even though you know how much I hate calling you and talking on the radio.
I am pretty odious. I understand.
I know. I love you. I just...
I know. I know.
This whole idea that, you know...
But the thing is, by making this call and starting where you started and describing your reality and having people like Jeremy and Tamara say, you know, Vermont, California, same, same, then maybe somebody gets empowered to start talking about some of the things that you've talked about or asking whether these programs are in place, these little, simple, positive steps. And maybe, I mean, is this one of those moments where we say, if we can save one child?
Maybe. I mean, you know, I think one at a time may not get us anywhere fast enough.
No, but with most of these things, if you're doing it for one, you are by definition doing it for several more.
Right. Well, it's like, you know, I, at my previous school and now at this school, I'm the keeper of the backpacks. I'm the person who has the extra school supplies for refugee kids. Used to be because I worked with the refugee organizations and it was easier for them to have one point person. Now it's because I know how to do it, even though the refugee organizations who no longer get federal funding for school supplies are no longer providing it, and so my Facebook friends are providing a very large chunk of what is currently on those books on those shelves. But what I used to do when I was at the high school, I don't necessarily have the most organized office ever, by any means. I would purposely put the pencils in one corner and the paper in another corner and the folders in a third corner of my office so that to fish around and look for stuff. Because when kids came to me to replenish their supplies, I would use that as an excuse to say, so how'd that chemistry project work out? Are you passing math? Need any help with this? You know, and a different question every time I went to a different corner of the room. And so that allowed me to check in with the kids just by me being inefficient by where I kept the school supplies. I really do address this one kid at a time, one meeting at a time.
And that, well,
that
because like you said, you teach kids, not books.
Right.
And that circle, yeah, that circle, that completes that circuit. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I think it fits perfectly in the larger dynamic of what we've been talking about for the last few days. Because it strikes me that we're even though we consider things like Brown versus Board of Education striking down the Plessy notion of separate but equal, we've got a lot of schools in this country that are separate and unequal.
Right.
And the challenge, I guess, is to try to remedy that.
I agree.
So, is school back in session now?
No, the kids come Monday. So we had 2 days of teacher in-service stuff, of which my colleagues and I gave 25 minutes to everybody yesterday. But we did it in groups of 20, which was nice. And then Thursday and Friday are department meetings, team meetings, and finish putting your classroom together, and then the kids come on in.
Well, let's start. School started back today here, so Doodle is now officially a high school senior.
Congratulations.
Our last child is in her last year of public school. Wow. Kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. I remember when they were little.
So do I.
I mean, you know, mine's now a college junior, so.
And Cassie's on her way to law school.
Yes. Cassie started law school yesterday, I think.
Oh, was yesterday day one of 1L?
I believe so, but I could be wrong.
Oh, Hadley versus Baxendale. Yep. Wow. Well, you know, maybe we'll get a dispatch from her at some point in time if she's not just a complete ball of stress.
Cassie, stress.
Oh, no. I know. No.
Cassie.
Yeah. She's probably sitting in some nickel a draft beer hall even now in Philly.
Do they have those?
Okay, I guess it's a dollar a beer now. Who am I kidding? It's three. For the bad stuff.
Yeah.
A little Schaefer, maybe.
And it's the Northeast, so six.
Yeah, no kidding. I hope she wore her cowgirl boots the first day of 1L.
Ask her. I have no idea. I don't get that level of detail.
Okay, I'm going to have to inquire. Maybe we need a dispatch.
I think we do.
Because, you know, those first couple of days are freaking baffling. Because everybody's speaking a language you don't necessarily speak.
I hope it's all that she wants it to be.
No, I do too. I do too. It's a fascinating educational process. It also is a sort of educational hazing.
Well, I think her whole first year at Princeton was like that.
Probably so. Probably so. Betsy, have yourself a good night and good luck as the school year starts.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Texas Betsy, getting ready to start another year of educating America's future. Lines are open if you want to jump into the conversation, 304-574-8178 on this not as prayer meeting-ish as it usually is, prayer meeting Wednesday. Thanks going out. Robert's up over down under 20th of the month challenge is on the table. And I am proud to say that Asa and Robert and one other individual have gotten us three-fifths of the way there. There's $20 remaining in the challenge. A dollar at a time, $5 at a time, 10, 20, whatever. You've got a chance to double your money up to $20 more if you want to help us meet the fundraising goal for this evening. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
What's up, Bob?
We know, Jim.
Pretty good. I just what you were talking about earlier about the police and dealing with the police. Believe it or not, I've had a run-in or two with them.
No.
And yeah.
Well, I think your dad had a couple of run-ins, didn't he?
Well, that's with the feds.
Yeah.
And that actually would. The local police, well, you know, with his position, he argued a case before the U.S. Supreme Court or something regarding free speech or something. Some judges didn't see things the way he saw it. I can't remember exactly what it was, but that was, back in the 60s. No, my run-in was one I remember when I was living in Vegas. I See, when I was 10, 12, I had like two brain surgeries, I had brain aneurysms. And with each surgery, you get like a quid pro quo if you survive. You can't eat this for that. And first I lost my peripheral vision and my right eye, a good part of it. And then the second one was a twofer. First I noticed I couldn't read, so I was like all of a sudden kind of dyslexic. The words went backwards, it just, you know, didn't make sense. So it took me a long time. I mean, it still takes, I still read kind of slow, but I probably read a fair amount of books compared to most people, I think. But then the final one was, I was epileptic, and because the scar tissue. And, well, luckily, phenobarbital controls it. And then I decided, in case I get stranded somewhere or get lucky and I end up staying somewhere, blah, 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 you know, I always carry one with me. So if I, you know, and I can usually go, because the phenobarbital builds up, so you can, you know, you don't have to take it every day, but you want to keep it at a certain level. So anyway, a cop stopped me, and he found the phenobarbital. So, and I was like a block or two from my apartment, and I said, you know, I said, well, I got the prescription at home, but no, he took me down to Clark County, and appearance for court. So I go to court a couple months later. They don't call the case, and I said, what happened? They didn't call the case. Well, they're probably going to dismiss it. So then they dismissed it a month or two later. And then 6, 7, 8 months after that, I get a summons again. Some new ADA or whatever decided to bring up the case. So I talked to an attorney, and they wanted like $5,000. I'm like, I think I can do this myself. And I talked with one of my brothers who's an attorney. And he said, yeah, that was going to do this anyway. Just bring in your phenobarbital. Get a printout from, I guess it was Walgreens at the time. It shows my drug purchases from that store. And it was all phenobarbital. So I presented that to the court, and I told them the story about the brain surgeries. And, you know, and the epilepsy. And so the case got dismissed. But, you know, they offered me a plea bargain. And that was a felony, too. So, I mean, if you know, I can see how it could be real easy. Your life can get, just turn on a dime, you know what I mean?
In an instant, in the blink of an eye. And, yeah. and that's, you know, that's the polar opposite of what this officer professor Sanil Dutta was talking about. He says no one can ever understand what it's like to be a cop. He doesn't seem to do a very good job of understanding what it is to be a human being.
Exactly. That reminds me of another time I got arrested, and I asked, what am I being arrested for? And this is a cop. This is a long time ago. I think this is in New Orleans. And a cop tells me, oh, don't worry, I'll think of something. And he ended up, you know what I ended up getting charged with? Impersonating a police officer. And I never identified myself as a cop.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So, hello?
No, I got it. No, it's really impersonating an officer. Jesus.
Yes. Yeah, so they can charge you with whatever they want. I mean, you're going to, you know, and then you're in jail for at least 12, 14 hours till you get out. And then, you know, and then it's, you're told that they're, you know, I don't know what that police official you were talking about. I was listening to him earlier when you were talking about him, you know, And I kind of understand the cop's point of view a little bit, but my sympathies go more with the people, generally speaking. You know, I mean, because they do have the gun, final, you know, and the law on their side. So, and then the other thing I was going to talk to you about was what they've been doing to public schools over the last 30 years. Texas Betsy. That's who you're talking to earlier, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And, I'm 55, just turned 55 a couple weeks ago. I went to nothing but public schools, and it was a lot. You know, and I graduated, in 77. But it has, you know, I noticed the changes, you know, with the white segregation started, you know, it just seemed like the education kind of went down, but then it seems like they're doing everything they can to defund it, just like Texas Betsy was talking about. You know, we're programs that really don't cost anything that will help people who are struggling and their families and help society, but it seems like it's the 1% world where, no, we need worker bees, worker class.
Jim, it goes beyond that because we have an attitude that obtains now in this country that poverty is a character flaw. You know, in other words, you wouldn't be poor if you weren't such a non-quality person.
Goes back to Calvinism. Isn't that Calvinism a sentence almost?
There you go. A member of the elect. You're wealthy because God loves you.
Yeah, it's like I remember a couple of senators, Republican senators, they'd go ahead and cheat on their wives and all right, but that was their right because they had achieved such a position. I forgot who it was. They're just basically really going against their so-called Christian values. It was all right because they had gotten to that point, you know. I guess, you know, they had that relationship with their magic sky friend. I guess it's kind of obvious. I'm an atheist, you know. But, talk with Texas Bassie was awesome. So I'm gonna let you go on that.
All right, Jim. You have yourself a good evening. Good to hear from you. Take care now. And that's our buddy Jim from Louisiana Stan. And again, we are trying to finish out the last $20 in Robert's Up Over Down Under 20th of the Month Challenge. $20 to go in any combination, 4 at 5, 2 at 10, 1 at 10, 2 at 5. You pick. It's PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com, and Robert would very much like to see this completed before the close of the program, which is now a little more than 10 minutes away. So thanks to Robert and Asa and Marty, who are the respondents thus far to Robert, different Roberts, Up Over Down Under Challenge. Thank you very, very much. We've got just a few minutes left in the program, and by way of counterpoint to what's going on in Ferguson, I thought I might share with you a story that was brought to light by the columnist Leonard Pitts, Jr., a Pulitzer Prize winner down at the Miami Herald. he writes magnificently, and when he takes on issues of race and class, well, he does a tremendous job. So in discussing the events in Ferguson, he says there will be no in the aftermath and whatever comes next, he says there will be no shortage of good ideas: dashboard cameras, community policing, the hiring of more black cops, the removal of military hardware from police arsenals, sensitivity training. He says, to these, I would add a suggestion. A suggestion that is admittedly less sexy than any of those, but which I think has greater potential to make fundamental change in the long term. In a word, education. Beginning as early as the latter elementary years, schools should offer, no, require, age-appropriate cross-cultural studies that would, in effect, introduce us to us. Meaning not some airy, fairy curriculum of achievements and accomplishments designed to impart some vague intracultural pride, but a hard-headed, warts-and-all, American history designed to impart understanding of who we are, where we're from, and the forces that have made us. Inner-city black, Appalachian white, barrio Mexican, whatever. You might consider this a utopian idea. Maybe it is, but I've never been able to shake a conviction that if you walk the proverbial mile in another man's shoes, you inoculate yourself against your biases toward him. Nothing could be more true. And again, we're not talking about a program that has to cost millions of dollars. We're talking about simply talking about and teaching about each other to each other, as he says, us to us. If, me being the nattering nabob of negativity that I apparently am, if we want to. I'm sorry, but I get the notion that there's a whole bunch of America that not only isn't wondering why we're in this handbasket and why it keeps getting warmer, but are okay with both and rather like it. There's no getting around the idea that there are a whole bunch of those freedom protector woods out there with their Gadsden flags and their tricorn hats, who at the same time back at home have a sheet and pillowcase in the closet that they like to get up and dance around in from time to time. And they're looking for the first opportunity to start shooting. They got their Glenn Beck freeze-dried food all stashed away. They've been buying ammo for all they're worth ever since the election returns came in November 2008. And by God, they're ready. By the way, the Beckerhead is right upset. It turns out there's a new video game coming out in which the bad guys are running around calling themselves sovereign citizens and waving Gadsden flags. Yeah, he's real upset. He's afraid somebody's going to take a shot at him now. Because we all know that the problem is not with guns and access to guns in this culture. The problem is kids and video games. Interestingly, he wasn't so concerned when he was empowering people to go and maybe take a pot shot at the people who go to work every day at, say, the Tides Foundation. No, because you know, that's them, not him. But also contained in Leonard Pitts's column is a story out of Miami. Those of you who follow sport, and especially the NBA, know who Ray Allen is. Played for the Heat last year. has a house in Coral Gables. Turns out a bunch of teenagers who he says had been at a party at a house near Ray Allen's, a bunch of teenagers decided to break into Ray Allen's house. Ray Allen wasn't home. Ray Allen's wife was. She screamed and chased them out of the house. She didn't kill anybody, even though it's a stand-your-ground state, we all know. Here's where it gets fun. All of the kids were white Hispanics. And they said, you know, it was just a harmless prank, man. I mean, we thought he wasn't home. We just wanted to see how Ray Allen lived. So we broke in. They were questioned. They were given a stern lecture. And they were told to go home and not ever do it again and go and sin no more. At this point in time, everyone within the reach of my voice, everyone hearing this is going, wow, if that had been six or seven black kids, whew, mm-mm. Maybe you handle something like that with a good talking to. Maybe that worked. Maybe they apologize. Maybe they'll be better people for having gotten caught at that. Maybe it might have been a good idea, even if somebody thought that Michael Brown had stolen some cigarillos from the local convenience store, to sit him down and give him a good talking to instead of blowing his right eyeball out. Anybody? Just saying. Leonard Pitts says, we have been too sanguine for too long about such inequality of treatment in a nation whose birth certificate says all men are created equal. We have only the one country, and we can either tear it apart or figure out a way we can all live in it, in justice and thus in peace. To do that, we must stop being moral cowards, stop embracing the idea that somehow our racial and cultural challenges will resolve themselves if we just don't talk about them. Ignore it, and it will go away. Take a good look at the carnage in Ferguson and ask yourself, how's that working out so far? Not so well. Not so well. Time to get on out of here. Thanks, everybody, for joining in for this prayer meeting Wednesday, not-so-prayer meeting-ish edition of The Horn. Thorn in the Side Thursday follows tomorrow. I have no doubt that it will be an absolute sticker bush. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Thank you to Betsy and to Thomas for jumping in and finishing off Robert's Up Over Down Under 20th of the Month challenge. It really does matter that these things happen. Thank you. And thank you to Marty and Asa and Robert for being the other part of filling out that challenge. Y'all doubled your money. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the Horn chat room, our moderators, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.